Welcome to my new podcast. Today's guest is Joel, a resident fellow at Yusof Hall. Joel is also a solo bassist in his spare time. So, hello, Joel.
Hi.
Welcome to my new podcast.
Hi, Gio. Nice to be here.
Hi, Joel. Nice to meet you too. So, okay, why do you become a resident fellow in Yusof Hall?
Why did I become a residential fellow? Well, it was because I bumped into one of our ex-residential fellows.
Oh.
And when he's actually bumped into his wife, and then she was telling me about the work, and I was actually really drawn to just hanging out with young people, but not just about the hanging out. So like when I was younger, you know, I had a couple of mentors who made a really big difference in my life, and they were always about, say, 10, 15, 20 years ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, well, this might be a good opportunity to hopefully be a mentor to some, or at least to, you know, lay a path for some young people in Yusof Hall.
Oh.
Young adults in Yusof Hall. And so I thought, yeah, sounds like a really meaningful job. So I decided, yeah, let's take it up.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So what is your job scope as an RF actually?
I think on paper, my primary job is just residential life, right? Just to ensure that all the additional activities that the students do here in Yusof are kept safe, purposeful, meaning it's not just done for the sake of doing it, but it's purposeful in that it's, you know, goal-driven and it's, you know, there's some form of learning outcome.
Oh.
And on paper, that's really my job scope, lah. But I think personally, I just see it as multiple opportunities to impart or to mentor young adults.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And hopefully contribute in some way. Yeah.
So I assume in that case, you're like around 10 to 20 years older than the average Yusof resident?
Yes, about 10 to 20.
Okay.
Yeah, around there. Yeah.
Okay.
Not shy about it at all. It's okay.
I mean, that's your goal also, right? You want to train like, those group of people in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the young adults here are very, very smart.
Hmm.
But I think it's more than just brains. And so hopefully I can, you know, offer something that's useful.
I see.
Mm.
So how do you find your work as RF so far?
Actually, I've been loving it. It's been very, very enjoyable.
Wow, that's nice.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying it. I get opportunities to work with leaders as well as Yusofians.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, it's been a learning journey for me as well. I've learned a lot from the people I've worked with. So actually, it's been really fun.
Oh.
I do enjoy it. It's a bit tiring though. I don't know why all of you start your meetings at 11 or 10:30. When the rest of the world is going to bed, but it's understandable. Okay.
Because we're in Singapore.
I don't think it's a Singapore thing. Yeah. But it's been fun. Yeah.
Okay. I feel like having meetings in the evening is like a Singaporean thing. Because like sometimes I talk to non-Singaporeans living in Singapore and then they are also taken aback at the meeting culture in here.
That's
staying up late
okay.
to meet. So, yeah, like I talked to some of my friends from other countries, like even myself, when I came here, I didn't really expect to have meetings at like 11 or something.
Maybe it's just, you know, maybe we're just very practical. We don't want to interrupt everyone's, you know, schooling. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I hope we start to get some boundaries there though. I think it'd be better.
Not have late night meetings.
No, if we do have late night meetings, hopefully over supper, a drink, or you know, something a bit more social.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
That's interesting. So you mentioned earlier that you work with some leaders. Like what kind of leaders are those?
Well, here in Yusof, I think I work mostly with the sports leaders as well as the band heads. So it's largely in these two areas. But we also work very closely with the JCRC, which is like the main group of leaders that represents the student body.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I get to work with all these various leaders in different ways, whether it's about a CCA or it's about the strategic thrust for Yusof and where they want to lead Yusof. Yeah.
So means that you mostly work with JCRC and CCA heads, right?
Most of the time.
Okay.
I mean, my block heads as well,
mm-hmm.
As well as my, like any other student that I bump into or I happen to have an opportunity to interact with.
I see. What about with fellow SCRC members?
What, do I get to interact with them? Is
in what scope do you work with, like, with them?
Oh, I mean, our main goal is to just ensure that everything runs smoothly in the hall, right? So,
mm-hmm.
we often have meetings to talk about student matters and the way things are being run in hall.
Uh-huh.
And mostly we are really concerned about safety and leadership development.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So what are your most memorable experiences as a resident fellow so far?
My most memorable experiences? Wow, there's so many though.
It's okay. Yeah. Can talk okay. about it.
All right. So, I mean, I've shared a fair bit about students already, but I'll tell you something interesting about you. So there's actually quite a fair bit of wildlife here.
So
among the animals I've seen, unfortunately, a paradise tree snake, but that was, that I saw that snake dead.
Oh.
But we've seen civets a number of times. We've seen yellow-crested cockatoos. We've seen hornbills, of course, the occasional squirrel.
Mm.
I've seen pictures of otters.
Oh, wow.
And the most recent one, I think it was a spotted owl.
Oh, wow.
So we saw an owl flying around. It was on the rambutan tree just outside my apartment.
Oh.
And then it flew to the back where the drain is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's a really lovely owl. It's nice and big. Big eyes staring right at us. Very, very calm.
Not yeah. creepy?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
It looked very wise. Like most owls do. Yeah.
Oh my God. Why are owls considered wise in the first place though?
I don't know. I don't know.
Guess we'll have to find out after the podcast recording.
Yeah, sure.
Oh yeah, I remember one time one of my blockmates caught a live snake in the room.
Yes, I think they do come in every now and then. Was your blockmate on the ground floor?
No, it was on the second floor.
Oh, that's interesting. It must have been slightly terrifying.
Oh yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's move on to your experiences in music. So
sure.
You currently play bass as your primary instrument, right?
Yes.
So why did you take up bass?
Well, this was a couple of years ago.
Oh.
So you might not know, anybody who hasn't played in a band might not know, for some reason, people, you know, the bass is not an instrument that draws a lot of attention to it.
Oh.
So when, you know, it's the one instrument that like bands typically find the hardest to fill. The one position, right? So a couple of years ago, this was many years ago, I think maybe 22 years ago. So I was playing in the band in church, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have a bassist. Oh. Surprise, surprise. And so I was playing keyboards back then and I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. I play a little bit of guitar. How hard can playing one note at a time be? And so that's when I picked up my first bass. It was a friend, he worked in a studio. There was a spare bass lying around. He brought it down on Sunday. I used it on that day without any prior practice, right?
Wow.
I played the right notes at almost the right time.
I see.
But that's when my love for bass started.
I see. So basically you played jazz.
Jazz. I see what you mean. The right note at the wrong time or the wrong notes at the right time.
Actually, what's your opinion on this?
What, on jazz?
Yeah. What is jazz?
What is jazz? What a big question.
Which one is it? Is it the right note at the right time, the right note at the wrong time, the wrong note at the right time, or is it the wrong note at the wrong time?
I think it's the wrong note made right.
So, means that it's wrong notes, right time?
Not strictly speaking. I think there are many, yeah.
But you are leaning more towards wrong notes, right time?
Yes. Because I think there's, yeah. I mean, like if you're out of tempo, you're out of tempo. That doesn't fit. But, you know, if you're playing the wrong note, it can be purposefully wrong and it can be made right depending on the context, right? So you can deliberately hit something that's not within the key. But given the way your progression is moving, it can sound correct.
I see. Yeah.
But if you're off tempo, you're off tempo. There's no.
It's okay. You can always just call it microtone or microbeat or whatever.
Is this? I've never heard of that.
Yeah. I don't know. I think microbeat is just a term I made up. But then like some people actually like try that. Like,
oh, are you trying to say polyrhythms?
Probably that. Okay, yeah, my music theory is like, I'm sorry, guys. I disappointed you, all of you.
No. Mine is not fantastic either.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So
that's how I took up the bass. I fell in love with it.
Oh.
And actually one of the reasons I really liked it, because it was very low key. I kind of like being in the background and no one really knows what I'm doing.
Oh.
But it's still an important job, because like when the bassist drops, right? Or if the bassist decides not to play, you feel the difference. And the moment the bassist comes in, it lifts the mood, but no one can tell why. It just, you know, that's what I love about it.
Why is there suddenly the other guitarist? And why is the other guitarist so good, right?
Yeah, people tend to notice the guitarists, the drummers, the singers, the keyboardists, you know, but no one really notices the bass, which I like.
You actually like not being noticed, huh?
Yeah, I kind of like being in the background.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. So is that why you gave up the piano too?
No. That's not why. I didn't give up the piano. I just have been spending more time on the bass, that's all.
I see. So that you become less noticeable over the years.
I wouldn't say that was my goal, but yeah.
Okay, so you've played like bass and piano or keyboard so far, right? So how do you learn those instruments?
Oh, it's a long time ago. I think I was 6 and my mom asked, do you want to learn how to play the electone? I think that's what it's called.
Yamaha. Yeah. The Yamaha one, yeah.
Yeah, and then I went like, yeah, sure.
Oh.
And then I kind of enjoyed it, but I actually never practiced.
Oh.
So I only ever really played it when I went to class. And every year she would ask me again, do you want to continue? And I always say no. And then she always say, well, you've really come this far, why not go a bit further? So this kind of went back and forth up till the time I was maybe 17 or 18. So it went on from electone to piano.
Oh, wow.
And it was always the same thing, right? Because I never really practiced my piano, right? I did it because I had class. And eventually when I hit, I think like I only hit grade 7 in piano. It's not terribly high. And then that's when I really stopped lessons. But after I stopped lessons, I started learning how to play by ear, started to explore chords, started to learn about modes and different types of colors that you add to chords. So what's interesting is that, so I came to this conclusion, I think all those years prior, I was learning to play the piano, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't necessarily learning music. And there's a difference between learning how to play an instrument and learning about music as a whole. And I think if I had learned music and how what I was learning fit into the broader context of what music is, then I might have been a very, very different musician, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. So your first instrument is the electone, right?
Piano maybe, more than electone. I think the electone was only for 2 years.
Oh.
At Yamaha, after that, my teacher came out of Yamaha and then I just followed her.
Oh, yeah. And then you learned piano instead of electone.
Yeah, then I went out to piano. It was mostly classical piano.
Oh, wow. Okay.
ABRSM.
Yeah. I see, interesting. Mm-hmm. I was a Yamaha student also, for almost my entire life.
Wow, okay. That explains it, Gio, because I've noticed that Yamaha students tend to have really, really good years.
Really?
Yeah. No, so for example, all of you in Yamaha, I mean, I forgot all of it, learnt solfege, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So even if you don't have perfect pitch, right? A lot of Yamaha students, at least those who have gone on far, have very, very good relative pitch.
Oh,
very,
see,
very good. And very, very good tone recognition.
That's an interesting insight.
I mean, that's what I noticed.
Now that I think of it, I think you own to something. I think you want to do something.
Well, there's something about the Yamaha syllabus, right, which really encourages listening. And I think that is the right way, you know. Technique can be picked up later to a certain extent. But what you hear, not just what you listen to, what you hear from any given piece of music, right, informs your brain about what you can produce, you see.
Oh,
so if you don't hear it, you can't produce it. So isn't hearing the most important part? Right? You can learn physical skills later. But if you don't hear that color, if you don't hear that inversion, if you don't hear the inner melody, if you don't hear resolution, how are you going to produce these things in future?
Oh,
right?
Yeah. That's
so totally I think listening and understanding music is actually the more important skill, not so much being able to play a song.
Mm.
Yeah. And back then I was just like, 3 songs a year. The 3 songs that I had for my exam.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I ever learned.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I think my experience is quite different. Because, my Yamaha teacher also, teaches for, let's say, ABRSM exams in some other sessions. So,
okay.
I took both. I took the Yamaha group classes. I took the piano classes, like right. private lessons.
Right.
And then there, like, I learned both the Yamaha repertoire and the Ebirazem repertoire. Yeah. Sometimes there are songs that are in both, sometimes they are not. And then like we just like learn like a lot of different songs.
Yeah.
So it's not like 3 songs a year, it's more like, I don't know, 20 songs a year.
Which is way more than 3 songs a year for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely a better place to be in.
I don't know. Here's the thing, right? Like, realistically, if you want to become like a well-known musician, like in terms of techniques, then it's better if you learn 3 songs a year. So it means that you can focus on those 3 songs and play those 3 songs well compared to playing like 20 songs and then 20 of them are just okay-ish, which is what I am, lah. I can play 20 songs a year, but all of them are just okay-ish because I cannot focus on one of them. I cannot like just like spend like say 4 to 6 months on one song, right?
Well, I mean, if your 3 songs are like huge concertos, then okay, you know. But my 3 songs were like 3 pages long.
Wow. Okay, that sounds like a different story.
No, but to be a famous musician, to be someone who's recognized, I think that takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more that goes into it than just talent
and
ability. Yeah.
I see. I feel like quite a lot of my friends, both in Yamaha and otherwise, those who are actually very, very good musicians and professional musicians, mm-hmm. they tend to practice at least 5 hours a day.
And wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. And what I know is like most of competition winners, let's say Chopin or Liszt competition winners, they practice like 8 hours a day. And even like in other instruments like Manuhin also, they usually say they practice 8 hours a day. And Christian Lee is just an outlier. Yeah, 3 hours a day and suddenly win. So
they're always outliers for sure.
Yeah. As everyone says, roses are red, violets are blue. There's always an Asian better than you.
Oh, I've never heard this one.
Oh, yeah. I think it's much said if in like two-set violin or something, like sometimes that like, when they see an Asian prodigy and they're like, oh, yeah, there's always an Asian better than you.
I mean, I don't think it's anything to do with our
race.
Or our ethnicity.
Yeah.
But I guess there is a certain thing about Asians and the work ethic, maybe.
Tiger parents.
Yeah, maybe it's the parenting. I'm not sure.
You know, like last time I interviewed like a few other musicians,
right?
Like Anya also mentioned that, oh yeah, I learned music because my parents asked me to learn music and so on. So there's that. A few people, they also started learning their instrument because their parents forced them to, just like myself. But then like some of us like actually ended up loving the instrument.
Exactly.
And I think that's how Anya also started off, like, oh yeah, I learned the piano. But then like, she eventually went to vocals, but then like, she just plays the piano every now and then, just like she's not confident, even though she's like better than me or something.
Yeah.
And I think at one point in season 2, episode 2, the one with Valerie, I also mentioned like about one of my fellow Yamaha student who was really damn good lah. And we all know he plays 6 instruments. We all know he practices like 8 hours a day just for whatever performance. He can do like 6 songs in a day for the Junior Original concert. So that's what he's well known of. And 6 songs for 6 different people and 6 different instruments. So like, it's like all in the instruments on stage he can play. It's like that type of person lah. But that kind of stuff is,
if only he could play all of them at the same time. You know Jacob Collier, right?
Of course I know.
Yeah, so maybe he's the only one who can probably play all at the same time. With the help of a looper.
Oh yeah. He can play how many instruments? 15 at least?
I don't know. And everything in his room. That's for sure.
Yeah. I wish my brain is big sometimes. I listen to Jacob Collier and then...
And then you're like, you're just imagining his music in your head now, I suppose.
Yeah. See, the thing is, sometimes I listen to musicians and then I forget who the hell they are. Like, I listen to Jacob Collier and then I vibe to it until I remember that this guy can play all the instruments in the song and he edits them himself. He produces them himself and then I get emotional damage.
Emotional. I mean, we are all given, you know, different gifts and strengths and different combinations, like, you know, of our personality, our interests, and our context. So, you know, he's an amazing musician and singer and producer. It doesn't make you any less of a musician and creator yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get. Thanks.
And he'll never be able to create the music you create. Just as it'd be really hard for you to create the music he does. And that's the beauty of it, is he?
Yeah, it is diversity.
Yeah. But the best part about him, in my opinion, is that he's so down to earth. Like, no airs about him at all. Mm. You know, he doesn't... I'm sure he knows how good he is, but when you watch him on YouTube or when he's interacting with people, it doesn't seem like, you know, he behaves like he's entitled to the attention. You know, he treats everyone with respect so far. I mean, I don't know him personally, yeah, but based on the information available.
I see. Yeah. Last time I watched his logic breakdown session, I forgot what it's called, but it's that one. Oh,
they're so good.
I watched it on Moon River. That's the only one I've watched. I think I learned a lot. I feel I learned a lot more in that 90 minutes than in my entire 15 years of learning music before I watched it.
Is Moon River the one with Take 6 in it?
No. Moon River is the a cappella one.
Yeah,
that got the Grammy win.
Yes. Moon River. Let me just check.
Is it the one?
Because
I don't. Take I mean,
6 is
they probably sang the intro, but I don't know. The intro people are not credited. I mean, there are 150 of them. How do you credit all of them, right?
The session breakdown.
Yeah.
Amazing number of tracks, man. I don't know how he... Yeah, let me see. Oh, Grammy winning, that's right.
It's the one where...
I'll go find out. I thought he collaborated with Take 6 at some point. So Take 6 has been around for a while as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're an a cappella group.
Mm.
Yeah, my brother introduced them to me when we were kids.
Oh, wow. So, means that they've been there for quite a few decades, huh?
Yes, 15 to 20.
15 to 20.
No, I don't know how long they were around before that.
I see.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yep. But anyway, I'll go check it out and let you know.
Okay, I will also go find out what Take 6 is. Because I just know them because Jacob Collier collabed with them at one point, but then I never really listened to them.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was Moon River or something else.
I mean, they're probably there because he doesn't credit all of them. And then he just rattles off all the names.
Right.
Oh yeah, this is my mom. This is Chris Martin. This is John Mayer or something. Okay, yeah. A bit of a sidebar. So what do you think of your 2 years of Yamaha experience? Do you think they built some foundation for your music now?
It's really hard to say because I can't remember anything from my Yamaha days.
Okay. I mean, you're damn young, right? At that time.
But I believe it would have made a difference because I remember bits of, you know, clapping out rhythms together with the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
I remember bits of singing and, you know, experimenting with intervals.
Oh.
So I imagine it had an impact, maybe not a deep foundation, but a foundation nonetheless, right?
Oh,
something that's still important. So I'm not sure, but I think if I stayed on with Yamaha, I probably would have been had a better year. Because thereafter, it felt like I was just preparing for exams and I wasn't necessarily, you know, taught how to appreciate. You know, for example, my teacher would always tell me how I should express a particular phrase, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it was never what do you think? What do you hear? Where's the melody heading? What would you do in this situation?
Hmm.
Would you bring it up? Would you let it die down? Would you do something else just to contrast?
Oh.
These questions never come up when I'm playing the piano after that.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, and we hardly ever listened to top recordings, for example.
Mm.
I would listen to it on my own.
Oh.
Yeah, but my music teachers never put up any music for us to listen to. In fact, it was my music teacher in school who actually got me interested in symphonic music. So she played this CD. I don't know if you've heard it. Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra.
I've heard of the guy. I don't know the title.
It's really good. So what happens is that it's this same theme, this motif, right? Bum, 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 ba da 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 bum, ba da 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 ba dum, ba da 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 ba. Probably in the wrong key. And how it's written is that it introduces each section, whether it's the wind, woodwinds, or the brass, or the strings, and so on. And even things like the percussion, the timpanis. And they will play this theme, right? Over and over again, section by section.
Huh?
And then instrument by instrument. Oh, and then they would introduce it. Next, we have the violas. The violas are da 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 da. And the cellos are a big... You know, so they'll talk about each instrument.
Oh, wow.
And it really got me hooked. So then that music teacher organized a trip down to Victoria Concert Hall.
Oh.
And then SSO played this piece. And it was really... I mean, that just opened up my ears. to the sonic palette available in a symphonic orchestra.
Wow, I see.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Wow, that's interesting story. Wow. My experience is quite similar. Like in Yamaha, I actually got asked though for some reason.
Right.
Like, I've had four teachers in Yamaha throughout my entire whatever number of years time there, and all of them actually asked me like, what can you hear? Like, what is this piece going to? Should you play this softer or louder? What are the repetitions involved? And so on and so forth. And I think it helps me like analyze pieces. But unfortunately, my music teacher at school wasn't that because he was more into teaching like, you know, the basic stuff of music rather than like going to orchestras and watching your orchestra. But my IT teacher surprisingly likes orchestra and classical music, so he was the one who brought me to the local concert hall that is Aula Sinfonia Jakarta, and
and that was your exposure.
That was my exposure. He asked me to watch at this one. Then sometimes I would just like ended up sending concert details back and forth, and then sometimes he would tell me, "Oh yeah, this guy is good. This guy is not good," and stuff like that. So
very nice.
So now I go Yong Siu To sometimes to watch.
I'm surprised you didn't sign up with Yong Siu To coming to NUS.
I told you I did not because I don't think I'm confident enough. Because like, see, the thing is, music was always my side thing. Right. Like, I can play, but it's not something that I put as priority because like, I don't take music curriculum in school, so it's not realistic for me to like devote a lot of my time into playing music. Like, I can only practice like around 2-3 hours at most. Like I cannot like go 8 hours and then do all the qualifications and stuff that Yong Siu To actually wants me to do. Because like even the repertoire list was quite hard lah. So when I came to NUS, actually I applied for the Audio Arts and Sciences program as a second major or minor, I forgot.
Okay.
And I got rejected. Because at the time I didn't really play well. Like I used I played Moonlight Sonata, third movement.
Okay.
Yeah. And I played on this very keyboard, but I think I sucked because I haven't practiced it in a long time and I suddenly had to practice it in like, I think it was only like 1 or 2 weeks that I need to relearn that song because I was very busy with exams beforehand. So
fair enough.
Yeah. I ended up like sucking at it and I got rejection. Yay. So now all I can do is just watch people from YST or Audio Arts and Sciences and getting emotional damage from all of them.
Well, you never know. I mean, rejection isn't always the worst thing in the world.
Indeed.
You never know what good came out of that. And like they say, right? Like hindsight is 20/20. When you look back, you probably realize one day, well, maybe it was for the better anyway.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I guess it's quite the same. Like, as you may know from some previous podcast episode or something, I got into a music college.
Ah, right.
I got into their music production and engineering program.
Yeah.
I rejected the offer because it was expensive. And now here I am. Okay. And here I actually like played in a lot more bands because back in high school, I only had like around 6 months of band experience. And that too, I wanted to do a bit more, but then like COVID hit, so can't really do a lot more, and here I actually learned a lot on how to complement other instruments and how to use different sounds in the band setting instead of like in a solo piano or even electron setting, because like that's what I did like I arranged songs for electron that I played myself. I know what the hell I'm doing, but then if I'm dealing with other people, basically I have to know what the hell they're doing, right? So that I can play whatever the hell I'm supposed to play. So I guess I learned a lot. I finally don't get scolded as often as I did when I was in high school and new to band.
Oh, okay.
So
you're the experienced one now. You're the one who helps people.
Yeah.
Kind of get to where, you know, you need them to get to.
Yeah, I try because I see some people also, they come here without band experience, and that's where I came from too, like classical musician to a bandit. And you want to become good at band, right? If you want to stay in band and become a good bandmate. So, yeah, as much as possible, I try to help out other people for the lulz.
And I'm sure there's a lot for people to learn from you as well. I mean, given the exposure, the experience you've had. Yeah.
Thanks. I feel like I have a lot to learn from the other people I'm helped. Because they have much more classical experience than myself. They have a diploma. I don't. I suck. I cannot get a diploma. Although I'm learning diploma level pieces, I would say that. But I don't play in a diploma level yet. I play like very slow, very sloppily, very unstably. But
yeah.
I mean, like, if you can get a diploma, confirm you're better than me. Otherwise, I would have got a diploma by now. But
you know, it's interesting that you said, I mean, I heard you say a number of times, Gio, that you suck. I honestly don't think you do. But I did want to share something. Like recently I was recounting to a colleague of mine that where I stand in terms of my music is actually something that I strive to apply in my own life as well. So let me explain. I'm not the most brilliant bassist or musician around, right? And I know that, right? I also know that I've put in a fair bit of effort and I've reached a certain standard. So I'm neither the best nor the worst, which is pretty much true for all of us in life. We are very seldom the best at something and very seldom the worst at something, right?
Oh, yes.
But when it comes to music, right, I'm actually very comfortable where I am. Not in a sense that I am complacent because I'm still trying to grow. But I don't beat myself up, right, that I'm not any better.
Oh.
I don't feel like, gosh, why do I suck? I kind of go, oh, I can't do that yet. Let's, you know, figure out how I can get there. But the funny thing is that sometimes in real life, I do judge myself more than I should. So that's the thing. Why is it in music, right? I don't judge myself as much, right? But then in my own life, I sometimes wonder, well, I should have achieved this by now. I should have been able to do that by now. It's a self-reflection, but I'm glad that at very least, right, my musical journey has given me this insight, sir. Yeah, and I hope you kind of arrive at a similar place that it's not that you suck, Gio. It's that maybe you just haven't learned those skills or you can, you know, but you know exactly what you need to do to get a bit better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I do.
Yeah.
I want to ask people to teach me how to get a diploma because, I don't know,
if that's important for you.
Good question. I don't know. It's just like, I think I want to pursue it a bit further now that I see people with diploma and then they play classical better than me, and I feel like inspired also. I want to see what I can do with more time, if I can devote time for a diploma, because I feel like I can. It's just that I've never had the time, but let's see if I even have the time in the first place, because I don't think I do.
If it's important enough for you, you make that time, I'm pretty sure.
Indeed.
But you use the right word, inspired. As long as it's not, you know, envy driven, I think inspired is the right way.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I will keep that in mind. Okay. So, move on to the next question. Sure. So, what are your favorite genres or musicians or songs to play?
Oh, wow. Because I play a lot more on the bass now. So, actually, I've been listening to a lot more funk.
Oh.
And a bit more modern type funk instrumental, or, you know, funk covers. So people I listen to and try and play are people like Corey Wong, Wolfpack, Scary Pockets, and a few other bands here and there. Yeah. So that's what I've been drawn to.
Oh, wow.
But before that, maybe John Mayer. I really enjoyed John Mayer. As a young adult. At one point, Jason Mraz.
Oh. Where's Jason Mraz now? I think he just disappeared.
Yeah, but I realized I've always been drawn to music that's a bit more rhythmic rather than melodic or anything that has a lot of harmonic content.
I see.
So most people, for example, like a good melody and really meaningful lyrics. The songs I like tend to be rhythmic with interesting, you know, syncopation.
I see.
So
jazz and funk.
I enjoy jazz, but I don't understand it. And because I don't understand it, and it goes back to our earlier point about what you hear, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't understand it, I cannot reproduce it. I can't create jazz.
I see. So you just enjoy listening to it, but you cannot play it.
I very, very rudimentary. I mean,
I see.
I'm beginning to explore using flat nines, But I mean, it's a long way to go, lah.
Oh yeah, that's true. Mm. I'm also starting to learn jazz because why not? And yeah, probably because some guy from my country played jazz and got like 3 Grammy nominations for it while being like
12. Who's that?
Zoe Alexander.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Inspiring.
Yeah, indeed. I have like all his albums in my computer right now.
Right.
Sometimes I listen to it and then I vibe to it because damn, his songs are good. His composition is good. And then suddenly I remember he's more than 2 years younger than me and then I get emotional damage.
You know, you really should stop beating yourself up.
I yeah, I agree. I mean,
all given different, you know, gifts and talent.
Yeah, I really should stop getting emotional damage. Yeah, and start learning.
You really should. Yeah.
Yeah.
Be inspired, yeah, but don't beat yourself up in the process.
It's true. Okay, so now that you've mentioned what you learn and what you like to play, so earlier on you mentioned that you think that it's important to learn how to hear certain things in songs and how to notice like what's going on in the song, like so what are the skills that you think are important to learn as a musician?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. In my opinion, the most important skill to learn as a musician is the ability to listen. To the ability to hear. I'm not sure if there's a real difference between the two, but I guess when I talk about listening or hearing, it's not just about enjoying the music, but to ask, to kind of put yourself in the musician's shoes and go like, why did that person do that, right? Like, what, you know, let's say it's a simple progression, right? And you're using all the chords within a chord family.
Oh, yeah.
And the person decides to use, let's say, a 2 minor instead of a 4 major.
Oh.
You know? Or why did the person add the 7th or, you know, the 9th, for example? Why did it not resolve? How did it going to this particular chord, you know, what effect did that have? So I think when we start asking these questions when we listen to a song, then we start to understand music a bit better. I think listening is probably the most important skill when it comes to learning any instrument.
So it means that analyzing is important.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, but you know, you can't analyze as well without any music theory. So I think a lot of musicians, especially musicians who learn on their own, skip music theory. But it's extremely important because music theory helps you to understand in order for you to then create.
Oh yeah. I remember the guest star before this, Dio, he also mentioned that because he learned by himself, he used to like skip music theory. He thinks it's not important and so on. But then like, eventually after he got into more and more bands, he realized that, oh yeah, I cannot say what the hell I'm supposed to say.
Yeah.
I can demonstrate it for you, but I cannot tell you what it is. Right?
Right.
So that's when he started like
learning.
Yeah. See. So you've played like 3 instruments, right? Do you have like any instrument specific skills that you think are important to like those instruments?
What are most important? Or
actually any lah, like what you think is important. Doesn't have to be just one most important one.
Okay.
Can be anything.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm actually, for some reason, I'm drawn to talk about skills that are inter-instrument or like not non-instrument specific. So we talked about listening, for example.
Oh yeah.
But I think a really important skill. So let's talk about skills now, right?
Yes.
And well, I mean, actual physical skills, like actually being able to play. I think a really important skill is how to practice. And it sounds really cliche, but I can't remember this quote exactly. It says something like, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting the different result.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the same thing with music. Like, I think when I was younger, when I practiced, right, I made a very big assumption that repetition would make me better.
Oh yeah.
But I now realize that it's not repetition that makes me better at doing it. It's repeating the right thing. You know? So it's not just repetition, but it's right repetition.
Oh yeah.
Or correct repetition. And so all these additional things like slowing down, like really, really slowing it down, figuring out the most efficient fingering.
Oh.
you know, finding a different way to play it. Like on the bass, for example, there are multiple places where you can start on the G note, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you start it from this point? Do you transit to another string? Do you use this finger? Do you rake downwards or up, you know, or do you... So there are multiple things to think about, and all that contributes to then being able to practice. And I feel that if you know how to practice, you can take it to any instrument and still figure it out. Yeah.
I see. I think that's what the very old saying goes, perfect practice makes perfect. Right?
Yeah, that's right. It's not practice makes perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect
makes practice. Perfect, but perfect practice makes perfect.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, so yeah, I'd say knowing how to practice is very important.
Mm.
Specifically on the bass.
Oh, yeah.
I'd say the next most important skill is a deep, deep sense of groove. Very, very, like, you know... So one of the best exercises I've done is practicing my bass with a metronome, but skipping beats 1 and 3.
Oh.
So that's where the kick usually lands, right?
Oh, yeah.
So the metronome will only go 2, 4, 2, instead of 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh.
1, 2, 3, 4. But what I would make the metronome do is 2, 4, 2, 4. And I would play on the 1 and the 3.
Oh.
And so, you know, this interaction between when the metronome hits and I play a note gives me a better sense of whether I'm in the groove or in the pocket or not.
Mm.
Because it's not guiding me all the way. It's not robotic. I kind of need to find it and really feel. So it I find that it's a really useful exercise to help me internalize the sense of groove. Yeah.
Doesn't that help you keep tempo too?
It does, but it's more than tempo.
Mm.
Because groove is more than tempo, in my opinion. Yeah.
I think that's what everyone says also. The other day, I went to a jazz workshop and I asked the facilitator, what is pocket? And then the guy went on like a 10-minute explanation of like different songs and the pocket's there. And then I didn't get an answer.
It's really hard to
like,
describe.
At the end, I just asked like, so basically, does pocket mean rhythm and syncopation? Then the guy said,
no. I bet it's not. It's not, right? I'm guessing.
The guy said,
what's his answer?
The guy is like, you can't say that.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not. It doesn't... You see...
What's the pocket, though?
So that's the thing, right? Like, any explanation to describe it never ever hits the nail on the head. But the moment you try to hit the nail on the head, you're probably out of the pocket, so to speak. So, oh, how do I describe it? I guess it's something that you feel more than... You see, if playing in the pocket means playing perfectly to tempo, right? Then electronic music will always feel like it's grooving. But it doesn't, right? It doesn't have that groove.
Mm.
And if you... Okay, so maybe one way to look at it is this. If you pull out a Mac and you have Logic, Logic has a smart drummer.
Mm.
And if you just switch on the smart drummer, he's going to play in tempo.
Mm.
But it might be really straight. Right? It's very, very straight. But they have a little dial called swing. And if you turn up that swing a bit more, you find that you want to move a little bit more. And that is groove. And it's never, ever really perfect.
Oh, yeah.
So, but you feel it, right?
Hmm.
You feel like a...
It feels human, right?
Yeah. There's something more human about it. And even if it drifts back. So there's a certain sway to it. I haven't looked in detail into what it means, but I think that helps to define groove.
Okay, I see. Thanks for the explanation. I remember at one point I read an explanation that basically says that in order for drumming to be grooving, you need to delay like some of the beats by, I think, around 2% or something. That if you delay it within that amount, it doesn't feel off tune, but then it's grooving.
Yeah, but you can't delay everything either.
Yeah.
Because if you delay everything by 2%, then the drummer is just playing 2% slower.
Or faster.
So there are some things that are still in tempo and some things that are always late or always early, you know.
Yeah, a bit somewhere, right?
Yeah. So it's how it comes together, you know. Yeah, the whole is bigger than some of the parts, right? Like just how the whole... drum beat comes together. Yeah.
And also I think like if I listen to songs sometimes like the instrument is swelling a bit, so it kind of gives like a kind of delay, right? I think that's what I did also when I used to produce electronic music.
Right.
I think like I just like I used the swelling to my advantage. At that time, like I used an electone. I actually like recorded stuff on an electone and then made electronic music out of it without any further editing except for like putting the right tracks at the right time. But I feel like when I made the track, right, although like all the drums are in time, tuck, 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 and even all the bass are something like that, they're all in time,
but
there's swell in the strings or the synthesizers or some other instrument, right? That time of attack, it gives like some sort of grooving vibe, I think. Okay. I think that's how it works.
Yeah, so, I'm not really an expert on this.
I'm also not an expert. I just, it's just some random thing that I pull out of my head. somewhere.
I think that's the best we have. So if you're listening to this, maybe you can ask Gio again and he'll have a better explanation by then.
Hey, Fido Gio, if somehow you find an explanation of this, please put the link in the description or please like write up something or pick something. Just put it in the description. Okay, thank you very much. Anyway, so I assume you also do like some audio recording or editing. So what do you use to edit or record? Like what kind of mics or DAW do you use and why those?
So I'm a Mac user. So very naturally, I get drawn to anything that works with a Mac. I use Logic as a DAW because I think among the other DAWs out there, I didn't want to spend too much on all the plugins, right? And so from what I've read and what I've heard, Logic is pretty good out of the box. So I wouldn't have to spend so much extra.
I see.
So I started using it. But I don't actually record too much music. I record more voice work.
Oh, I see. So what kind of stuff do you usually record? Like spoken word like this?
Yeah, I actually record spoken word a fair bit.
Oh, okay.
So I do record voiceover work every now and then.
Oh.
Audiobooks, announcements, corporate videos.
Oh, so you're a voice artist.
In a way, I just don't sing.
I mean, isn't there like a difference between a vocalist and a voice artist?
Yeah, there is. So yes, I'm a voiceover artist.
Wow, okay, nice. So
on the side.
I see. That's interesting. So what is your hardware stack that you use to record?
My equipment?
Yes, your equipment.
So I use a number of different microphones. So typically most voiceover artists have a large diaphragm condenser.
Uh-huh.
So I use a CAT E700S or E100S, I'm sorry. So I bought it because it's a very sensitive microphone, so it picks up a lot of nuances.
Oh.
Number two, the reason I bought that is because it's got very, very low self noise. And the third reason I bought it is because it's a super cardioid.
Oh.
Right. So its pickup pattern is a little bit narrower than your typical cardioid.
Mm-hmm.
And which means it will reject more sound off the sides.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Because I don't really have a soundproof studio, that super cardioid does help.
Yeah.
But on top of that, I sometimes record with MKH-416.
Oh.
So that's a shotgun mic and it's used for a lot of like movie trailers. It's quite a well-known industry mic for voiceover work.
Oh.
It's a kind of mic where, you know, you get like people recording in a world where people don't, you know, that kind of a voice.
Oh.
So that gives a very good presence.
Mm.
And then sometimes I use a large diaphragm dynamic if the room is not very well treated acoustically. Yeah, so those are the three mics I use. Then the next thing that's important is a good preamp. So right now I use an SSL interface because the preamps are quite nice. Yeah.
I see. So which mic are you using now?
Right now? Oh, this one is a Beyer Dynamic M201TG. So this is a dynamic microphone. It's a small diaphragm dynamic.
Oh yeah, I can see it's way smaller than what I'm holding right now.
But it's got a fair bit of proximity effect, meaning if I bring it closer, it gets boomy and deep.
Oh yeah.
But it rejects a fair bit of sound. So I think I've read that the BBC uses this in their studios.
Oh.
But you can hear. So look, I'll snap my fingers in front of the mic and go to the side and you can hear how the sound changes. So in front, it sounds like this. And off to the sides, it just doesn't, you can't hear much of it anymore. You hear that?
Yeah, right.
In front. and then off to the side, you can't hear it. So I love this mic. I use it. I even use it when I go on Zoom for meetings and all that.
Mm.
Yeah, it's pretty good rejection.
I see.
This is hypercardioid, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, wow. Okay, so yeah. Why did you bring this mic today instead of like your other three mics?
Well, I thought there'll be two of us talking. I thought you would have appreciated a dynamic mic, which gives you a cleaner sound per channel.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because Gio, I see you're using a condenser.
Yeah, I am.
And so a condenser will probably pick up a lot more of the room noise.
Oh,
and
yeah, that's
if
true.
If you go back and listen to your own track, you probably hear a lot more of my voice even in your mic.
Actually, back in my previous podcast, I usually record like with double condenser. So like, I use a condenser, they also use a condenser. And most of the time, like, I can hear my own voice in their track, but I cannot hear their voice in my track. I think I just speak like a bit loud. I don't know if that's the case. I mean, like if you look at this, your gain is double of mine. So
yeah, well, dynamic mics need a lot of gain.
Yeah, that's true. But then like even usually when I record using a condenser mic, even though I just set the gain like, approximately to the same level, but then like that's the case. Like I can hear like my voice in their channel.
Well, if we were recording, for example, in the room, then I would definitely choose a dynamic mic over a condenser mic. Because you know, the room, there'd be like the fan is on.
Mm.
There might be birds outside or crickets.
Oh, yeah.
So it all depends on the setting, I suppose. I took this one because it was on the table.
So that's the real reason I'll decide me.
I didn't want to, you know, go pull out. The other microphone is like in a... You know,
cabinet.
In a dry box.
And, oh, wow.
My own mini mic cabinet.
Wow. Means that you have quite some mics so that you have a mic cabinet.
I have a few. They're not terribly expensive, but I do take care of them.
Mm.
I bought one off a sale. It's not a very well-known brand. It's called Charter Oak.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Oh, you've heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Right. It's quite rare. And I love the sound of that mic. Right, but it wasn't made for our weather. So, you know, the humidity here in Singapore, like I started hearing cracks and pops like in the microphone.
Mm.
And then when I emailed the manufacturer, they said, oh, you need to put it in a dry box. You can't leave it out.
Mm.
Yeah. So I use that just on special occasions. It makes it's a nice one. I'm eyeing a Neumann one day.
Oh.
Maybe a TLM-103.
Oh.
That'd be very nice.
I also want to get it that if I actually become a professional music producer.
Yeah.
But then I don't know, like, should I get that or should I get something else?
I think you would probably end up getting a whole bunch of stuff.
Indeed.
Honestly,
I think you got to have a bunch of stuff if you want to be a music producer, right?
There are a couple of pretty good mics that give, you know, the classic companies a run for their money. I think, what's the name of that brand? Lewitt.
Mm.
I think Lewitt is really quite good.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll look at it.
Sound quite good.
I see. I'll look that up. Thank you very much for the information.
Sure. Anytime.
I'm using a mainstream mic. Damn it.
It's a nice mic. It's a Rode. What is it? A B1 or?
NT2A.
NT2A, yeah. It's got multiple pickup patterns on it, right? So you've got figure of eight. So you can do a lot with this mic. Nice pads on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good mic.
I consider getting the 80-20-50, but then this is much better.
That's Audio Technica, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Audio Technica.
Oh, they have pretty good mics too.
Yeah, they have pretty good ones. I think at one point I saw Lee Chun record using an 80-20-20. I mean, I was there, I called it with him, then he recorded his own voice using 80-20-20.
Yeah.
So it's good. And then I looked up the 80-20-50, but then somehow I found this and then I was like, wait, this sounds much better and it's not even double the price, so
You know, actually, if you set it up on figure of eight, right, and you put the mic between you and your guest, you only need one mic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, if this is right in the middle, so let's go on, Gio's chair. Are you on figure of eight now?
Yes, it is on figure of eight.
So you should be able to pick up. But it's strange, it's not picking up. Why?
Good question. Is it? It is on figure of eight now.
Is it the gain level? Shall we adjust your gain and see how it goes?
Okay. Wow, that was loud.
So if I speak on this other end, it does seem a bit softer though. It doesn't look the same.
Is it just because
you're louder?
I feel like I'm loud there. Because like from experience, okay, that's
from experience, you're loud? Okay.
Yeah. Am I loud? I feel like you're around the same loudness level as me. I don't know.
Well, I'm trying to speak up a bit now. So
yeah, you are. I can hear that.
Yeah. But even then it's a bit softer at the back.
Okay, that is very interesting. I don't know.
Are you still figure eight or you switch back already?
I mean, I'm still in figure eight.
Okay.
Let me just test. This is me for using the back. And this is me using the front. Yeah, it sounds almost the same. So maybe it's just, I don't know, maybe my voice is made for mics or something.
Maybe your voice is made for mics, it's true.
Okay, let's go back to the normal mode, which is...
cardioid?
Yeah, the cardioid mode.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Just make sure I set your... Because I just set your gain earlier. Do you want to talk?
Yay. What is up? Yay. Look,
okay, sounds okay. Good. Looks good.
It sounds looks sexy. Okay.
It looks good. All right.
Let's go. Okay, so from your work in like audio recording and editing, do you have like any tips for me so that you know the podcast actually has a good audio?
I'm not terribly good at audio recording, especially when you talk about multi-track and music. But if you're talking about single source audio, I say the most important tip for audio recording is to get it right at the source. So what that means is, if you record a good source, meaning let's say if you're using a microphone, make sure you record it in a place which is acoustically treated. Mm-hmm. You're not picking up extra noise everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get that right, everything else is much easier to do.
Oh,
so record it right at the source or at the start. Other than that, it's a whole bunch of other things. Really, I mean, it's really hard to go down into audio recording tips. I think if you do that right, if you're recording instruments. Use a metronome.
Oh yeah,
because it's very hard to line up. Like everybody needs to use a metronome, including the singer,
especially the drummer, I think.
Oh, of course, especially the drummer. Yeah, so
I think the singer can just like not use the metronome and then groove with the drummer. But then if the drummer doesn't use the metronome, then they're dead.
Yeah, I guess it depends on like how you lay down your tracks. Like usually they will record like a guide track, then they will go on to do the drum and bass, and then they will lay on the rest later. So
I see. Maybe. I remember most of my band's recordings start with like a metronome and then the drum records on top of it and then the bass and then the other stuff in whatever order they want to.
Yeah. I think that's the way to go.
I see.
Yeah. So it's not much of a tip. I don't have much. Make sure you set good gain levels. You know, actually do the basics right and I think you'll be fine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when I took that one music production module, I'm sure you were there also, right?
No, I attended some. I didn't attend at all.
I remember at one point, like, the prof was like, so, remember that you have to set the gain level properly before starting recording because once it clips, then it cannot go back.
Yeah.
And then your take is ruined.
It is true.
So,
it is true.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, there is technology out there now, right, in which setting the gain level is not as important anymore. So, if you go and look at, for example, the Zoom F recorders, I think it's the F6 and newer. So they have like 32-bit floating and they have two preamps. One preamp that's set to low gain and another preamp that's set to high gain.
Oh.
What it means is that it's the equivalent of taking a raw picture in photography. Even if you have a very loud source and a very soft source, you can even all of that out in post-production. You don't have to worry about clipping. It's quite amazing. Yeah, I haven't tried it myself, but it looks amazing.
Looks amazing.
Yeah.
I see. Isn't that just the same as the pad function in most audio interfaces, just like this one?
Yeah, but the problem with the pad is that it cuts the levels going in, right?
Yeah.
And what that means is that your soft sounds become even softer.
Oh, yeah.
But what this does is that it records two signals, one at high gain and one at low gain, and it allows you to infinitely, well, to a certain extent, choose between the two and blend the two together. So
like compression.
It's not even compression. Go read up and watch a YouTube video about it. You understand it.
Okay.
I'm not explaining it well.
I see.
Yeah. So with an interface like that, it will make recording easier. But I don't know whether they have, you know, started including technology like this. I mean, those are field recorders, right? So people who hold up boom poles and record location sound be useful for them, right? Because like you might have set the mic preamp perfectly for conversation, but then a plane flies by.
Oh yeah.
Then what are you going to do about that, right?
Go wait for it.
So I think that helps.
I see. That's a very interesting thing. I'm going to look it up. afterwards. So
sure, it'd be interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I remember at one point, like, some audio interface manufacturers also start like making audio interfaces with auto gain setting. Focusrite had one recently.
Yep.
It's called the Vocaster series, which is like made for podcasts, but I don't have it.
It makes it easy, right?
Yeah, it makes it easier. You can't even connect Bluetooth to it, but that's like not the audio setup.
Yeah.
But then like to some extent, they can like auto gain you so that you sound like around the same volume. So you don't have to do like all the post-processing, I think.
Yeah, but I think that idea is good. Mm. So I'll go check it out.
Yeah.
Actually, you inspire me to start my own podcast.
Wow, okay.
Although I don't know what to talk about, but we'll figure it out as we...
I see.
As we move forward, I suppose.
I see. You know, the reason why I make the podcast into an interview podcast is because I also don't know what I would talk about. So
right.
Basically what I do when I choose guest stars is that I look at who is interesting in the group of people I know.
Okay.
Then I go around asking them, hey, do you want to spend 1 to 2 hours with me to podcast?
Right,
and and then hope they say yes. And in your case, you said yes. So here we are.
Cool.
I think you can do that also. Like, you can use it as an audio engineering project like I do. Like, this is an audio engineering project first and a conversation second, honestly.
That's very honest of you.
Yeah. I think I mentioned it quite a lot. Right? This is an audio engineering project. So, hey, to all of you listeners, this podcast should be taken as an audio engineering project. Please don't trust everything I say, okay? I'm just an audio engineer.
Okay.
But yeah, anyway, I think that's one thing you can do. Because I think over the past year or so making podcasts, I feel like every time I get a new guest star into the podcast, I look at a different audio signature. And sometimes I can start making out like when they say and oh and stuff like that, like just based on how it looks like in the waveform.
In the waveform.
So then like
within the door, right?
Yeah, within the door. So then like I can cut it wherever I need to cut. So I feel like some people, like including myself, I love my words quite a lot, and some people don't. And then you can see the difference in the waveform also. So that kind of stuff, I think.
Very interesting.
You can learn eventually. Oh, yeah. You have learned, like, I mean, you're a voiceover artist, you confirm know already, like, this kind of stuff, right?
I honestly don't really look at waveforms, per se, but I do look out for breaks in the waves, with the waveform.
Oh, means that you're pausing.
Yeah, and so, like, one of the things I do, I think I learned this, I can't remember who I learned it from, some guy on YouTube. When recording long-form audio, if I make a mistake, I shouldn't stop the recording. I should just go on. But I need to indicate somewhere in the recording. So I snap my fingers and then there'll be a nice big peak.
Oh.
So I know exactly where to go.
I see.
So like, let's say, for example, you know, Gio, when you go like, okay, future Gio, reminder, please cut this part out. What you can do is like, you know, click like that. And then all you need to do is look at your waveform. That's a point where I need to address.
I see. But
so quick tip for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. But then... what if you suddenly like mix it up with plosive?
Oh no, it looks very different because a plosive would probably have a tail at the end. Like if you say powerful and then you get the rest of the word, right?
Oh,
so, yeah. Should be fine.
I see. Okay, thank you for the tip.
No worries.
I think we have got quite a lot of snapping sounds, so I will go look at it when I edit. Hey, Fido Geo, please look at this. Thank you very much. Okay, so I think that's all for now.
Perfect.
Thank you, Zora, for coming to my podcast.
You're welcome. It's been lovely speaking with you.
Wow. Also, feel the same way. It's been interesting speaking to you also.
For sure.
And to my listeners, thank you for listening to my new podcast. And I'll see you all in my new podcast episode.